I'm David Lazarus, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 8th, 2013. This week, the Dow partied like it was 1999. It was 1999 when the Dow closed above the 10,000 milestone for the first time ever. So now that we're topping 14K, is it full speed ahead or party's over for our portfolios? Nearly all of us have skin in the game. Our retirement funds, our kids' college funds. Is it time to rethink our investment strategies? And if we've been on the sidelines, is it too late to get back in the game? To answer those questions, we're joined by Ken Winans. He's a portfolio manager and the founder of Winans International Investment Management in San Francisco. Hiya, Ken.
Hey, David. How are you?
I'm really well. All right. First of all, let's do a quick reality check. The Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's just 30 stocks. It's not the whole market. So even though we're up there in this nosebleed altitude, does this tell us that the entire market's on fire?
The markets are moving in a positive direction, and there's an awful lot of really good companies that are doing very well right now.
Then let's talk strategy. Some analysts on Wall Street are saying that we are at the outset of an enormous bull run. Obviously, nobody can say for sure. Should I be rethinking my allocation between stocks and bonds, go a little heavier into stocks at the moment?
Yes. Not to be in equities in the long term and not to be in good companies is technically a mistake. Now, you can find corporate bonds out there that are paying 5, 6, 7%. For a lot of retirees or people nearing retirement, I think that makes a lot of sense because you will need income when you retire. If you're younger and you've missed the bond market rally and you are looking at where do I put new money, I think you have to lean toward equities.
A lot of people rightly freaked out as the market was going in all sorts of directions, as the downturn worked its way out. They pulled out of the market. They got onto the sidelines.
Yes.
Here we are now in uncharted territory with the Dow. Is it too late to get back in?
No, it's not. But it's at the same time, nothing goes straight up. What I would suggest is this. There's also a seasonal issue within the markets. We have some very big tax bills people are going to have to pay in April. It will not surprise me to see people have to sell some of their stocks to pay those tax bills in April. So it's not a surprise to see the market have a temporary lull going into April. That would be something to check. The other thing, people are scared to death about the sequester situation and the continuing budgetary problems. This is going to be a reoccurring theme for the next 5 years.
Ken Winans is a portfolio manager, and he's the founder of Winans International Investment Management in San Francisco. Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
All right, you just heard about those tax bills. Really wealthy Americans are now reaching deeper into their pockets. The federal income tax on the top 1% is up about 6% as of January 1st. That jacks up the rich guy rate to its highest level since 1979. But before you shed a tear for old man Potter, you might be interested to learn that 1%ers are actually paying less in overall taxes than they were in 79. And there are a few other differences as well between now and then. David Weinberg has the story.
Let's start with the obvious differences. If you were a 1%er in 1979, you didn't have a cell phone or an iPod, but you probably had a tape deck that you used to listen to the number one album of the year, 52nd Street by Billy Joel. And I bet your favorite song was Big Shot.
Well, you went uptown riding in your limousine with your fine Park Avenue clothes.
From now on, I will refer to 1%ers as Big Shots. The average income for a big shot, adjusted for inflation,
it was about $413,000.
John Bacchia studies the income growth of the wealthy at Williams College. Today, the average income of a big shot is $1.4 million. So let's say we bring a 1979 big shot into the present day to buy a house in one of the 10 wealthiest zip codes in America. If you follow the golden rule and don't spend more than 30% of your gross income on your monthly mortgage payment, it would take the 1979 big shot 30 years to pay off that home. It would take today's big shot about 9 years. So why are the big shots so much wealthier today?
The big increase in the people who are in the top 1%, and particularly the top 0.1%, would be people in finance, you know, the Wall Street types, the hedge fund types.
Steve Kaplan is a professor at Chicago Booth. Statistically speaking, there aren't that many more people working in finance today than there were in 1979. But the ones that do earn 3.5 times more of the nation's income than they did 34 years ago. And much of the income that comes from the finance sector is not subject to federal income tax, when you factor all the taxes other than income, like payroll, state, and local, the wealthiest 400 big shots in America today pay about 16% taxes on their income. Using those same calculations, the average American pays 22%. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Speaking of the 1%, there's a pretty amazing viral video on the loose showing how wealth is distributed in this country. More than 3.5 million people have watched Wealth Inequality in America on YouTube so far. And one of the most striking stats from the video is this. The average CEO makes 380 times what the average worker makes. 380 times. We took to the streets to ask whether top executives are worth that much.
CEOs usually think they're the ones who tend to start their own firms and put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into what they're doing.
I think it's wrong. They should distribute it amongst all their employees, so maybe their employees got a little bit more money. I'm pretty sure most of those people have families to support.
It just seems a colossal amount of money for, you know, for what do they do for that amount of money? I don't know.
It's something that needs to change and needs to change quickly because the gap between the poor and the rich people is getting bigger and bigger. And I mean, it's not us who gets all the profit, it's people at the top.
I mean, most of these people started the business off or they clawed their way up to the top. And there's a level of killer instinct there that they need to have. They also have the ultimate responsibility too. If it doesn't go right, their head's on the block.
The people below are sometimes maybe doing the most work, but then the people up top are supposedly the ones who are organizing and managing those people to be able to do that, which can be very stressful.
The amount of money they make is almost obscene. But you have so many people in this country that are homeless or out of work or have poor children they can't support. And I think it needs to be spread out a little bit more.
I would certainly like to see them be more accountable. Well, at least when they screw up, they still seem to get paid just as much.
Hell no, it's not fair. I'm not saying that CEOs shouldn't get more, but 300 times? Come on, man. That is ridiculous right there.
Thanks to Marketplace's Kate Casey, Jason Slotkin, and Paresh Dave for collecting those voices from New York, Washington, D.C., and our hometown of Los Angeles. If you want to check out that video or weigh in on wealth inequality, join us at MarketplaceMoney.org. This program is in the market for new digs. By that I mean we've been taking the pulse of various housing markets throughout the country. Today, we head to Jackson, Mississippi to see if the warming trend that we've heard about elsewhere has also taken root in the South. Walker Tan is a broker at Jackson's Nix Tan and Associates. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Is Jackson the sort of place where people come up and say, hi, how you doing?
Yeah, they probably say, how are y'all doing? But everywhere you go, you know someone. And for some people, it could be too small of a town. But, you know, the city's actually a lot bigger than you think it is.
All right. Well, tell me about how things are going in the market. Is this a good time to buy?
Traditionally, we're used to seeing things really crank up about now. Is what we call the daffodil effect, which is basically, you know, once the daffodils start blooming and everything starts blooming is when the buyers really start coming out. And it kind of cranked up early this year for us. It started in February, and we do have things blooming.
Good daffodil crop this year?
Yeah, you'd have to ask my wife. Quite honestly, we've been in business since 1977, and this past year was our third best year. We never really saw the peaks or valleys that a lot of other markets saw. And our prices have remained pretty stable.
Why is that?
You know, we don't see a lot of people moving here. I hope this doesn't sound wrong, but moving here from other areas. I mean, most of the people here were raised here. They might have moved off for college, but it seems like everyone seems to come back home.
All right. How far is my money going to go? What does it take to get, let's say, a 3-bedroom house on a nice street in a good school district where, you know, I'm going to want to put down roots long term?
For $200,000, if you go out to the suburbs, you know, you can get a fairly new construction house, probably built in the last 10 years, and there's really good school districts. If you wanted to live in the city, you could buy, you know, an older home, you know, maybe built in the 20s or 30s that has a lot of character and charm. But, you know, when you say character, they just think maintenance and, you know, but you can get more of a tree-lined street, per se, in Jackson than if you move out to the suburbs, since a lot of the developers like to take down any tree in a way of a lot.
Tell me a little bit about the banks. Are they willing partners in real estate deals? Do they play hard to get, like in some other parts of the country? What kind of loans are they offering?
Well, you know, 5 years ago, if you were a young person just getting out of college and you had a good job lined up, you probably could, you know, walk into any local bank here and, you know, get a loan. Today, they're just a little bit tighter. You know, we see more young folks having to get parents to co-sign just to help them get that first house. Today, it's just tougher to get a loan.
And why is that? Are the banks just being choosier about things?
The banks are being choosier. It's definitely a buyer's market. In the way that, you know, our prices never saw that appreciation, and so the prices are somewhat deflated. And quite frankly, our rental market is so tough that it costs a good bit more to rent a house than to buy a house.
It sounds like my money's going to go far in Jackson.
You could probably buy a couple houses, I'm guessing.
I'm guessing not. I'm on public radio here. But Jackson sounds like a heck of a nice place to be. So you don't have any plans to leave, it sounds like.
You know, I'm third generation in this business, so I'm probably here for a very long time.
All right. Best time of year to go check out Jackson?
I would say March or April, you know, kind of before the humidity sets in. I've been out to Arizona a good bit, and I can take 115 degrees, but 85 and humid in Mississippi is miserable.
I am with you on that. Walker Tan is a broker at Nix Tan & Associates in Jackson, Mississippi. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You probably noticed all the real estate types you've been speaking with have been pretty upbeat about their markets. Kind of makes you wonder maybe they're glossing over some of the negative aspects of things. So we'd like to hear from you. If you've been shopping for a new home and you've got the scoop on your local market, get in touch with us and let us know how things look. You can tweet us at Radio Piggy Bank, reach us on Facebook, or contact us on our website, marketplacemoney.org. Jeepers, what time is it?
Mail time.
Mail time.
Mail time.
Mail time.
Mail's here.
Yay, it's mail time. We'll hit the phones in just a sec. First, I want to answer a couple of questions that popped up on Facebook and in our Marketplace Money inbox this week. Julie posted on Facebook about getting sales calls from companies despite the fact that her number is on the no-call registry. Is there a way to make the call stop, she asked. And I'm afraid the answer to that is maybe not so much. I was talking to the Federal Trade Commission the other day. They said to me, you know what you got to do? You got to go to our website and you got to log a complaint and we'll see what we can do, but we can't make any guarantees. Looks like there's more and more marketers who are just happy to sneer at the do not call list these days. Hang in there. Hope for the best. We also got something here. We got an email here from William in New Salem, Massachusetts, wrote to ask whether he can score a free credit report. And the answer to that is, you betcha. And what you do is you go online to annualcreditreport.com. They're all there. And here's a totally cool tip for you. If you space them out 4 months apart, one from each different credit reporting agency, you can have credit monitoring on the cheap, i.e. free, for an entire year. Here's also another cool tip for you. AAA outfits in various states will actually offer you free Experian credit monitoring. And all you've got to do is sign up for it. You got to give them your social security number, but that's not the worst of all possible worlds. And you get it a free email every month telling you how your credit report is doing. It doesn't cover all of the credit reporting agencies, but it covers one. And that's a good start. So go to the website of your local AAA, and that'll tell you what you need to know to keep things intact. All right, let's go to the phones. Our first caller is Elizabeth, calling from Brookfield, Vermont. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, how are you?
Great. I have this image of Brookfield, Vermont, snowy and beautiful and pastoral. I know you've had a lot of stormy weather this week, but is it like a postcard or what?
Well, it could be a postcard. It depends where you are. If you're up in the mountains, it's certainly a postcard. In other parts of the state, near where I live, it's out in the country, but it's starting to melt. We're beginning to have hints of mud season.
Mud season doesn't sound so fun.
Mud season is one of the trials of living in New England.
What about the maple syrup? Is it bodacious or what?
Vermont maple syrup is always good, unquestionably.
Don't you think other New Englanders might take issue with that?
No.
Well said. And the Chamber of Commerce gives her a standing ovation. Yay! All right, what can I do for you?
Well, a few weeks ago, my credit card, the only one that I have, was compromised. And in the course of getting excellent customer service from the bank and getting a new card and all that, I then got a follow-up letter from the bank that said that based on my spending habits, they were going to lower my credit limit.
That's a fine how do you do.
Now, on the one hand, I've had a higher credit limit on this card for all these years than anyone is entitled to. And so on the one hand, it didn't bother me until I began thinking about credit scores, which is your debt compared to your credit limit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, if they lower my credit limit, what is going to happen to my credit score? And I called the bank back, and they said, you need to call the credit reporting bureau. Well, you can't do that anymore.
Not
unless
at all.
You subscribe to them.
And even then, I mean, you've got to have sneaky private numbers and things.
Probably so. So since my window to opt out of this lowering of the credit limit expires soon, what should I do?
All right, I got answers for you, Elizabeth.
Good.
And the first answer is going to be opt out away. But first of all, before I get there, I just want to give you some props for limiting yourself to one piece of plastic. It's all you need, it sounds like. You don't need more. You've resisted all the other solicitations and come-ons from the world of credit to expand your horizons, and that's good.
Well, I hate to tell you, but now I have two cards.
Oh, well, see, after I sat here and poured maple syrup all over you, and now listen to this.
I have one for online shopping and one to carry around.
This is all smart. I always tell people no more than three pieces of plastic. So you're under the quota, and that's good.
Oh, good. All
and
right.
Also, you get milk and cookies for understanding the whole debt-to-credit ratio. In other words, how much you are actually borrowing versus how much you can borrow, how much credit mm-hmm. you have. And the best rule of thumb here is if you keep that ratio to around 30%, give or take, mm-hmm. with plenty of headroom, creditors look at you and go, ooh, what a good girl. God, we like her. She's just terrific. Now, as you correctly noted, if your credit limit comes down, the amount of headroom you have above your borrowing also shrinks.
Right.
And
right.
thus, your debt-to-credit ratio gets bigger. Thus, you look like more of a risk to the creditors, and that's not a good thing.
But if the credit limit drops, which I understand is a business advantage to them, but it's still got this. If I've spent no more than 30% of that, does lowering the credit have any effect at all?
No, it'd be negligible. But
okay.
If your prior use of the plastic was such that you know, you were able to get by, obviously, with that higher limit, if it comes down and you're still able to maintain 30%, great.
Okay.
More power to you. But chances are you're going to be backed into a corner a little bit, unless you just never use this plastic at all.
I've had that card for so long that I went through all the years when all you had to do was sneeze and they raised your credit limit.
All right. Well, my advice to you, Elizabeth, is see if you can opt out. See if you can maintain the higher credit limit.
All right.
Just simply because not only does it give you more wiggle room as a borrower, but it just makes you look that much cooler in terms of your debt to credit ratio.
Thank you. Well, that's what I thought I should probably do, but I wanted a little bit of corroboration there.
That's the smart play, and enjoy the syrup. All right. Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And from one snowy place to another, let's go to Joseph calling from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hiya, Joseph.
Hi, how are you doing?
So what do you do?
I'm a hairdresser.
Okay. And at this season, are people more worried about their hair or less worried about their hair because they're wearing a hat?
I think they're more worried about their taxes, honestly.
As well they should be. I mean, it's like here in L.A., when the weather gets bad or what passes for winter around here, all the trainers at the gym just have nothing to do, you know, until beach weather comes around again.
That's true.
So what do you do with your time when you're not snipping hair?
Saving money.
You're like a dream caller for this show.
Yeah.
I love that kind of thing. Okay, what can I do for you?
Well, we are taking my 83-year-old mother and helping her get into assisted living. And that means closing down her apartment and Basically, she has no assets except for Social Security, which is $700 a month, and she's got a 1995 Toyota Corolla. That is it. And we discovered that she has about 10 credit cards, mostly store cards, with about a $20,000 credit limit. So we have since canceled all the cards and all of that. But my question is, how does that happen, first of all? How does someone with that limited of an income get that big of a credit line? And what happens to the debt now that she is basically all of her assets will be going for Medicare and Medicaid?
Well, first of all, when it comes to that balance, you want to get rid of it. I mean, do what you can. Pool your resources as a family. Do what you can to get mom off the hook, because that's the last thing somebody living on Social Security needs to be worrying about. Now, more to the point, I'm guessing what happened here, and it's just insidious, is every time mom went to some retailer that she likes, those guys said, oh, and jeepers, if you open up a store credit card, we can give you a 10% discount, we can give you a 15% discount, and she probably jumped at it.
Right.
Thinking that it was a smart play because she was going to save some money. And not thinking about the consequences that she's going to keep racking up all this plastic. And in the eyes of creditors, therefore, she starts looking like a bigger and bigger risk to them, which can play havoc with her credit score. And as you've noticed, it makes it so much easier to start running up balances.
Yeah.
So it's a real dangerous game. And I always encourage people not to fall for it. I mean, if you can afford something at your favorite retailer, great. If it's the kind of store that you're just going back to time and time again, yeah, maybe get their plastic. But by and large, you don't need store plastic. Now, if your mom is in the, well, the state that you say she's in, have you talked about power of attorney with her?
Well, my older brother has power of attorney. We're ahead of that part of the game. I mean, basically, she will be kind of out of the consumer game from here on out.
Joseph, your mom's in assisted living. Why?
Well, mild dementia. She just doesn't take her medications, forgets to eat, that kind of stuff.
Now, when you say mild dementia, that sounds like it can be very scary. Is she still functional?
She's still functional, but she needs 24/7.
Can she look after her finances in any way, shape, or form?
Well, that's what we're all doing.
So it's a team effort now?
It's a team effort. You know, she's lucky she has five kids and everybody's pitching in.
Well, that's great. And I think it's great that you guys are all circling the wagons around mom, because that's the best way to transition her into this part of her life?
Right. Reluctantly.
Okay. And another way of dealing with something like this as well is you can put credit freezes on her credit files.
Okay.
And then this might sound sneaky, but don't tell her the password.
Right.
And thus, anytime someone wants to issue her new credit, they come knocking at the door, the files are frozen, nothing happens, and you're in the driver's seat without having to go to all the rigmarole of a power of attorney.
Okay.
Just another way of dealing with a situation like this if mom or dad is a little reluctant to give up power of attorney, but you still want to get in there and start closing the doors on creditors. That's another thing to think about.
Okay, great.
All right. I hope that works out for you, Joseph. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Who's numero uno at Marketplace Money? It's you, silly. Got a personal finance question? Drop us a line at marketplacemoney.org. Next week, tax expert Luis Barajas will join me to talk about forms, filings, and other such fun. Send in your letters. We'll try and link you up with some really good tax advice from Luis. I'm not hanging out right here with you. I'm over at the newspaper writing a column on consumer affairs. My most recent piece looked at the pricing of generic drugs. And if you're like me, you probably figure that a generic is a generic is a generic, right? And the same generic drug from two different manufacturers will be priced pretty much the same because they're the same. Or apparently not. I recently spoke to a Southern California woman who went to a CVS store to fill a prescription for a generic antibiotic. She told me she paid $4.30. But when she went in a couple of months later for a refill, CVS said she'd have to pay $165 for the same generic drug. Excuse me? Turns out the two drugs were from two different makers. One company was charging what seemed to be a reasonable price. The other was charging a price 30 times higher for the same drug. This is how I learned about what the drug industry calls the average wholesale price, or AWP. Jeffrey McCombs, a professor of pharmaceutical economics and policy at the University of Southern California, explained it to me like this.
The AWP price is a made-up price. It's probably not real at all. And I'm not sure that when it comes to the actual price that's paid by distributors or pharmacy chains, et cetera, are that different. That's just like your hospital bill. There's no resemblance to reality whatsoever.
What's the takeaway here? It's this. Don't assume that just because you're buying a generic drug, you're paying the lowest possible price. And if you're peeved about what you're being charged, don't be shy about taking your business elsewhere. A different drugstore might deal with a different manufacturer, and that can make a big difference for your pocketbook. If you want to know more about this or weigh in with your thoughts, check out my column. We've got a link to it on our website, marketplacemoney.org. High drug costs won't come as a newsflash for people with chronic illnesses. Heart disease, diabetes, cancer, any of these can mean some seriously major drug bills. One of the priciest conditions is HIV. Earlier this week, doctors announced that a 2.5-year-old baby from Mississippi had been cured of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. She was only the second person known to have been cured since the global pandemic erupted more than 3 decades ago. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, approximately 1.2 million Americans are currently infected with HIV, which costs an estimated $400,000 to treat over a lifetime. How does the uncertainty of living with the disease and paying for life-saving medication play into financial choices? Here's one man's story.
My name is Leonardo Momplett. I'm 35 years old, and I've been HIV positive for almost 8 years now. I can recall the exact day that I was given my diagnosis. It was a little after 5. I went into this room where this woman was sitting on a balance ball. She sat me down, and she told me, "You have HIV. You've probably been positive for about a year." I asked her for about 10 minutes to cry, and then I asked her if we could go schedule my first appointment. And that was my first experience with HIV and having to figure out how I'm going to pay for it. When I first got diagnosed, I had been in Los Angeles for less than a year. I was working for nothing, peanuts. I didn't have insurance. I was pretty freaked out. Luckily, I was able to use the services of the Jeffrey Goodman Center and the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center. And they took care of me for about... I got diagnosed in May, and in October I got a new job with health insurance. I ended up staying with that job for 5 years because of the medical insurance, because I was petrified of being uninsured, and I was miserable there. In September of 2012, my partner added me to his medical insurance that he gets through his company. It's a PPO. It gives you a few more benefits, but it's very costly. I pay $200 a month for the premium, and then on top of that, co-pays and deductibles, and it really puts a strain on your pocketbook. I've had to cancel appointments, and I've had to cancel procedures because I know I can't afford to pay for it, and I don't want to be in a position where I'm drowning from medical bills. You really have to choose what it is that, you know, I might have all these things wrong with me, but the ones that aren't life-threatening, I have to push aside. I wasn't the best budgeter. I had come from immigrant parents. My mother is an orphan. My father left when I was 10. And my mother is not a good budgeter. And I recently learned within the last 2 years that how important it is. And I learned how to say, okay, these are the bills I have to pay. This is how much money I can spend. Yeah, HIV has taught me to budget. It's taught me a lot of things. And currently I work for $8 an hour, a minimum wage. Keeping me alive costs a whole lot more money than I'm making. You know, I'm lucky I have a partner, and we work together and we budget ourselves, and we have this much allotted for going out to eat and this much for groceries and fun. We have budgeted $30 a month for movies and then $50 a month budgeted for dining out. It's not easy to stay positive in this kind of situation. it's not easy to be happy every morning when you wake up thinking, you know, I'm going to have to be doing this for the rest of my life just to survive. If we are determined enough, we will be able to figure out a cure for it. We get a little closer every day. I don't think there is one person who has HIV who doesn't fantasize about not having it. It would be a pretty amazing day.
Tell someone that they're acting like a salesman, and they'll probably take it as an insult. Call them a used car salesman, and you can get a fist fight. The reality, however, is that we're all salespeople in one way or another. And if you're not selling yourself and your ideas, you may be missing the boat both in life and work. For more, allow me to sell you Daniel Pink, author of To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Daniel, welcome to the show.
David, thanks for having me.
So I'd like to think that we all don't have an inner car salesman or an inner Fuller Brush Man within us, and yet you say in your book, no, we do, and if we don't, we better find one.
Well, it's not so much the old-fashioned Fuller Brush Man or the old-fashioned car salesman that we have in us, but here's the thing. You know, if you look at the workforce, 1 in 9 people in the U.S. workforce are in sales. Their job is to get people to buy stuff. But I think what's also interesting is that if you look at what that other 8 in 9 does on the job, they're in sales too. They're spending enormous amounts of their time persuading, influencing, convincing people, trying to get them to part with resources, time, attention, effort, make an exchange. So like it or not, we're all in sales now. The good news is that sales isn't what it used to be, so you don't have to be Herb Tarlek or the guys from Glengarry Glen Ross or Willie Loman in order to do this well.
Okay, citing a whole bunch of very famous salesmen right there for everyone trying to keep up at home. When we think about this idea of the pitch and closing the sale, you'd like to think that your life isn't like that. And yet when you break it down, as you do in the book, your whole life throughout the day is a series of pitches and closing the sale.
In some ways, yes. I mean, that's what it is to make progress. That's what it is to be a human being. We're interacting with people. We want people to see things our way. We want to help people join us in making things a little bit different. And all of those are an element of sales. The thing is that in order to do it well, you don't have to be more sleazy. You have to be more human. You have to understand where people are coming from. You have to make things very clear to people. You have to talk in ways that resonate with them and that they can process easily. So this idea that sales is somehow inherently slimy is a relic.
So we've been talking about salesmen. What about saleswomen? Is there a gender difference to the techniques that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. The research is a little bit unclear about that. One of the things that the research shows very clearly is the myth of the extroverted sales star. We have this idea that extroverts make the best salespeople. What some new research from University of Pennsylvania's Adam Grant shows is that strong extroverts are actually terrible salespeople. So are strong introverts. The people who make the best salespeople are the people who are in the middle, what are known as ambiverts. They know when to push. They know when to shut up. They know when to assert. They know when to hold back. And it turns out in the distribution of introversion and extroversion in the population, women tend to be a little bit more ambiverted. Women test higher on empathy, which is a facet of attunement. And women in general are better listeners. There are a lot of people like me who, with the Y chromosome, who think that the opposite of talking is waiting. And that's a bad sales technique.
It's not waiting?
Yeah. It's they're active listening.
Oh, right.
Yeah, remember that?
I've heard about
that. Yeah. One of the things about listening, which is such a profoundly important skill, is that no one ever teaches us how to do it. I mean, we have the physiological capacity to hear because we have 2 ears and a brain that's connected to it. But no one says, how do you learn to listen better?
All right. I know how to sell my ideas to my editor or to a colleague. What if I want to sell myself if I'm out on a date or if I'm meeting somebody for the first time?
Yeah. If you read some of the literature on pickup artists, some of it actually reflects some of the research on attunement. For instance, it sounds duplicitous, but it's really not. This idea of mimicry. Human beings are natural mimickers. And we tend to reflect the postures, the...
Daniel's laughing because I'm doing exactly what he's doing in the same posture.
When we do it effectively, we do it less transparently than
that. You don't notice.
Yeah. We tend to mimic the gestures and the posture and even some of the word choice of people. It's a way we express affinity with them. It's also a way that we actually understand their own perspective. And so, you know, I think it's sort of being conscious that really understanding someone is in some ways a full body effort. It involves your brain. It involves some cognitive skills. It involves some amount of empathy, so some emotional intelligence, but it also involves a kind of physical component of sort of being conscious of how they're sitting, how they're standing. And so my best advice is simply to be conscious of where the other person is coming from. Try to see the world through their point of view. And also, here's the thing. I feel like I'm giving dating advice now rather than harvesting.
Well, finally, some news you can use.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Harvesting the literature on attunement. But, you know, some of it is being actually genuinely interested in what the other person has to say, asking questions that reflect some actual genuine interest, not working from a script, but actually being genuinely interested. And, you know, I have to say, the best sales job I ever did was 22 years ago when I made a pitch to my now wife to go out on a date with me.
My best sales job, I was working a summer gig when I was a kid. I sold Gene Kelly a pair of shoes.
Oh, my God. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
That's pretty awesome.
Well, it's Gene Kelly. It's not that hard a sale, you know.
Did he dance off?
If only. All right. Well, I'm sold. Daniel H. Pink is the author of To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Well, you sure persuaded me. Thanks for coming in, Daniel.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also, Daniel Pink has 5 tips to help you sell yourself to a potential employer. You can find them at marketplacemoney.org. If ever there was a time to sell yourself, it's when you leave school and plunge into the job market. But is a college degree enough? Marketplace teamed up with the Chronicle of Higher Education to find out what exactly employers are looking for in today's college grads. On the one hand, no surprise, they want bright, shiny degrees. Even in industries like manufacturing and retail, a 4-year degree is increasingly seen as a must. But what really gets employers' bacon sizzling is work experience. Marketplace's Amy Scott joins us now from the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore. Hi, Amy.
Hi, David.
All right, help me out here. I've spent 4 years busting hump for a degree. I've got my sheepskin in hand. I'm ready to go. And employers are saying, well, yeah, but where's all your work experience? Say what?
Yeah, I know. It doesn't seem quite fair, does it?
No.
So Marketplace and the Chronicle of Higher Education commissioned a survey of employers around the country who hire recent college grads. It was done by a firm called McGuire Associates. And about 700 employers responded. And they said of all the things they look for on a resume, the number one credential that stands out is an internship, followed closely by work experience of some kind. So to hear from one of those employers, we're going to have to take a little trip to the airport, okay?
All right.
To a company called Linear Air. And its COO is a guy named Peter Schmidt, who runs an air taxi business in Bedford, Massachusetts. And this guy's sort of a serial entrepreneur. He's run a bunch of companies and hired a lot of people. Right now, he's mostly hiring recent grads to do customer service, essentially sales. And Schmidt said what he really looks for are people who have some experience working with others.
Ideally, beyond just coursework, also if they've worked in their summer jobs or other positions where they've had to work on a team and solve problems, that is perhaps the single most important criterion for me. And that outweighs, you know, name brand or even, you know, other coursework.
And that really squares with what we heard overall in the survey, that internships were more important than where you went to college, what you majored in, even your grades. As one grad told me in a Twitter chat I did, my GPA got me an internship. My internship got me a job.
What are colleges saying about this? Are they now requiring internships of their students?
Well, some degree programs do, say in journalism or health sciences, require an internship or some form of what they call experiential learning. But often it's really up to students. And I spoke to one recent grad who studied mechanical engineering at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. David Carter told me that his professors advised him to do an internship, but he didn't really take it seriously.
If I had done an internship, then I wouldn't have been sitting on my thumbs the last 2 years trying to find a job.
So this is a guy with a practical major, engineering, right? Good grades, but he hasn't been able to find work, and he thinks that's because he didn't do an internship. And in fact, once you get out of college, of course, it's harder to get one or to afford to do one because you can't work for free or for very little money.
But the service sector accounts for about 80% of the economy right now, and not all of those jobs should require necessarily a college degree. And what you're telling me, though, is that a college degree is the path to the internship. So it sounds as though if you don't have one, you don't get the other.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we've heard lots of reports of this sort of degree inflation of industries that used to just require a high school diploma, now requiring an associate's degree or a four-year degree, and the jobs that used to just require college now wanting more, grad school. You know, nearly 7 out of 10 employers in the survey did say they would consider a really strong candidate that didn't have a degree. But there's just so much evidence in the economy right now that people with degrees are faring better than people without one.
But this just got even goofier now, because here you have all the employers saying, we want these guys to all to have degrees, make them smart and all the rest. And yet I'm always hearing from businesses who say they're dissatisfied with the quality of the crop of graduates that are coming out of American institutions. So what are employers really asking for here?
Yeah, this is really frustrating, I think, for people in higher ed. 31% of employers in our survey said colleges were doing a fair to poor job preparing what they called successful employees. So that's a sizable minority. And they said what job candidates were most lacking was things like writing and communication skills, adaptability, making decisions, problem solving. And they said it's college's job to teach these things. Some might argue with that, you know, that employers need to be doing more training on their own, especially in entry-level jobs. But nearly a third of employers also told us that grads are unprepared or even very unprepared for the job search. So there's some advice for people hunting for jobs. Employers said candidates need to do a better job of researching the organization and the industry that they're applying to, and, of course, work on their interviewing skills.
Amy Scott is on the Marketplace Education Desk. Thanks a whole lot, Amy.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, so Amy's told you what the ideal new college graduate, internship required, looks like. Now it's your turn. Helpful folk that we are, we've got a set of printable paper dolls that you can cut out and accessorize to assemble your top-notch college grad. That's at marketplacemoney.org. We like to air all sorts of points of view on this fine program. We play no favorites. Same for our sister show, Marketplace Morning Report, which airs, of course, in the mornings during the week. It recently asked a payday loan provider to defend his industry.
There's fees that are incurred from paying a bill late or overdraft fees that occur. And I know that my service is not only competitive with those fees, but in many instances cheaper than those fees. As long as people do the math, then they're not doing something stupid if they're going with the least cost.
Marketplace Money commentator Helene Olin begs to differ.
Every year, 12 million Americans take out high-interest, short-term payday loans. The industry claims it's offering a needed service by helping people who can't get credit anywhere else. And there's something to be said for that. According to a study by the Pew Charitable Trusts, more than a third of borrowers simply have nowhere else to turn. But something else is going on, too. The industry claims to be transparent, showing potential customers just how much their loans will cost if they pay them off within 2 weeks. But there's a major problem. It takes the average borrower not 2 weeks, but 5 months to make good on a payday loan. As a result, the debt rolls over again and again. On a $375 loan, they'll shell out more than $500 in interest. Supporters of payday loans say buyer beware. Customers are responsible for doing the math to determine what their loan will ultimately cost. But borrowers aren't expecting to take on 5-month loans, so they probably don't think they need to work out those numbers. Most of them expect the loan providers to give them the facts about fees, making claims of transparency disingenuous at best. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should take this issue on and insist the industry provide disclosure based on how people actually pay back payday loans in the real, not ideal, world.
Helene Olin is author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Right, so payday lenders are scary enough, but there are other monsters out there as well. If you're headed to the movies this weekend, you've got your pick of the paranormal. There's demonic possession.
Who's still out there?
Papa Lynn.
alien invasions.
Three different migrations coming from three different directions flew into your house. It's as if something was drawing them to your home.
There are people who have reported experiencing the same things that we have been experiencing.
And of course, zombies!
What am I doing with my life? I'm so pale. I should get out more. I should eat better. My posture is terrible. I should stand up straighter. People would respect me more if I stood up straighter. What's wrong with me? I just want to connect. Why can't I connect with people? Oh, right. It's because I'm dead.
Time out. That last one doesn't sound so scary. In fact, it sounds like everyday life for some of us. You know, I got to be undead to feel insecure or apprehensive about the future. So maybe this is why zombies are the monsters du jour in pop culture, bigger even than smoldering, sparkly Pacific Northwest vampires. The clip we just heard was from the zombie rom-com Warm Bodies. And don't forget The Walking Dead, of course, one of the biggest hits on TV. All right, two questions now. Why do we love these mindless, murderous creatures so much? And what could possibly be the money connection here? For answers, let's bring in Maria Pramaggiore. She is a film professor at North Carolina State University, and she says zombies help us connect with our feelings of social alienation.
These zombie films are using death or the undead, that boundary, as sort of the ultimate expression of feeling disconnected, feeling powerless. And as the author Huno Diaz has noted, unemployment. He points out that old school zombies, and that is going back to the classic zombies of the 1920s and 30s, were actually exploited labor. Their bodies were used in service often of, say, sugar plantations. They had a colonialist subtext. But of late, zombies don't have jobs. They wander and they threaten and they ultimately have, you know, their bodies destroyed. Vampires are sort of the upper echelon of the horror film world, right? They're aristocratic. They're European. They wear velvet. You know, we think of something like Tom Cruise in Interview with the Vampire. We almost even see there the vampire as the power of capitalism, whereas the zombie figure is really the working class, the plebeian. I mean, in terms of horror films, zombies are the lowest of the low. They always come in groups. They are, in many senses, the sort of great mass, the great unwashed, all of those negative terminologies that might be used to talk about the working poor, the working class.
There you have it. We love zombies because there's a little bit of them in all of us, except for all you vampire one percenters out there. Thanks to Maria Pramaggiore, film professor and associate head of the English department at North Carolina State University. Find out what your favorite movie monster represents, financially speaking, of course, at marketplacemoney.org. And that'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplacemoney.org, or you can get in touch with us on our Facebook page. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, we look at how immigrants manage to make it in America when they can't get easy access to credit.
It went from being a janitor to cutting grass to tutoring. I was writing papers for people. I needed money.
Marketplace Money is produced by Spooky Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Don't forget to set your clocks forward this weekend and have a good one.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.